The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Friends and neighbors, on this Friday, January 14, about 8:30 in the morning from Washington, D.C., and welcome to this week's Reporters Roundtable on the Bill Press Pod. It's been another busy week in the nation's capital with a lot of news centered on voting rights. On Tuesday, President Biden went to Atlanta to deliver a powerful speech in support of voting rights legislation, and for the first time, came out in favor of carving out an exemption to the filibuster for that one issue of voting rights. 2 days later, Biden met with Senate Democrats on Capitol Hill to convince them to pass the voting rights legislation, a plan shot down by Senator Kyrsten Sinema even before he arrived at the Capitol. In other news, in a case of dueling docs, Anthony Fauci had a fiery exchange with Senator Rand Paul. Donald Trump still on the warpath against any Republican who says he actually lost the 2020 election. And Democrats and Republicans paused long enough to pay tribute to former Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid. Here today to help us make some sense out of all of it, Eliza Collins, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And Jeff Dufour, editor-in-chief, The National Journal. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Bill.
Sudeep Reddy, back with us from Politico, where he is managing editor. Hello, Sudeep.
Hi, Bill.
So, hey, guys, we have to start, as important as the news is from Washington, we have to start with the big breaking news of the day. Australia, for the second time, has said that Novak Djokovic cannot compete in the Australian Open. Jeff, I'm going to turn to you as the sports guy on this panel. The Open starts on Monday. It looks like he's not going to play, right?
Yeah, and quite apart from the policy around this and the international politics and the public health, I'm just delighted, well, as a sports fan, because I don't want him to break Federer and Nadal's record. I like Federer Nadal a lot better than I like Djokovic, and I hope he gets banned from Grand Slams from here on out. He's 34 years old, so at some point he's going to get too old to win a Grand Slam, I hope.
And maybe
Nadal will win one in the meantime.
So you're rising above the healthcare concerns, but
I'm not rising above it at all. I am sinking below.
Well, it's amazing to me how much attention this story has gotten. It was the lead on the news that I heard this morning. But Sudeep, this does have resonance, this whole issue, in the United States, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It kind of shows the global politics involved here and the resistance to mandates, the difficulty of maintaining them. All of the questions about exemptions, all of this really just comes directly into this when you get into the details of this case, and it is just a hot mess. And you can only imagine we're weeks away from the Winter Olympics in China with a zero COVID policy, and just imagine the mess that's going to come with that just around the corner, and cases starting to climb in China and other parts of Asia. It's just going to be really an unfortunate situation, even if we're coming down in parts in big cities in the U.S. in COVID cases.
Right, and Eliza, he is sort of the leading anti-vaxxer in the world, I think, right? At least the best known, perhaps. And I haven't heard the White House comment on this case at all, but they must be relieved that an anti-vaxxer, it looks like, right, is going to not be able to compete.
They probably are, and it's one good thing for them on a week that was pretty bad. Yeah. I mean, this is coming yesterday. The Supreme Court blocked Biden's own vaccine or test mandate for businesses. So it does just show, I mean, obviously Australia is taking a much more aggressive approach from the government. The Biden administration has tried to do that to some extent and was blocked, I mean, at least on a part of his mandate. So they might be looking maybe even a little bit jealously at what's going on in Australia, the power the government can have over the vaccine mandate there.
Yeah. Djokovic has been asked to appear, I think, tomorrow in front of the immigration officials in Australia, where they said if after that hearing, they plan to detain him and probably export him. We will see how that goes. Expel, I think, is the word rather than export. Well, let's come back home here to voting rights. The president went up to Capitol Hill yesterday, met at the lunchtime caucus of the Democrats in the Senate. He came out expressing a certain determination, but also frustration. You can hear it in his voice. Here's President Biden yesterday following his caucus meeting with the Democrats.
We miss this time, and the state legislative bodies continue to change the law, not as to who can vote, but who gets to count the vote. That's what this is about. That's what makes this so different. I don't know that we can get it done, but I know one thing. As long as I have a breath in me, as long as I'm in the White House, as long as I'm engaged at all, I'm going to be fighting to change the way these legislatures have moving.
So what's going on, Jeff? The president must have known before he went up there that his chances of walking out with the Democrats all united behind this was not going to work. Why'd he do it?
Well, I'm sure he did know because Sinema didn't even wait for him to right. finish. That, which I got to say, that just shows how little political juice Biden has right now, even within his own party. It doesn't help that he got a 33% approval from Quinnipiac this week. But this was always poorly handled by Biden from the word go. I think he was too late to this. I think he had a little bit more chance to get something done on this a year ago when January 6th was still fresh in everyone's mind. But this always seems to have been a fool's errand for Biden. He kind of danced around it for months, much to the chagrin of some progressive groups and black leaders, so that when he showed up in Georgia, a lot of them stayed away from his speech. And then he gives a speech in Georgia that's panned in a lot of quarters as being too partisan, as being misrepresentative of some of the laws that have been passed, and just not – and failing to persuade anybody who he needs to persuade. So I think he was always behind the eight ball on this, and I don't know where they go from here, except, of course, reforming the Electoral Count Act, which he hinted at yesterday mm-hmm. after the lunch. He says it's about who gets to count the vote also. Well, if you're worried about who gets to count the vote instead of who can show up to vote, then that's what the Electoral Count Act is for, and you may actually have a bipartisan consensus on that starting to form. So I think he has no choice but to focus there.
Right. Well, at the same time, Sudeep, we learned that after this caucus, after the president's remarks, he goes back to the White House, and he invited Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to come down to the White House for yet another meeting.
Yeah, look, this is Joe Biden engaging in meetings and processes that are probably hopeless when it comes to the actual policy results. But they have to matter when it comes to the politics of it. He needs to show that he's trying on some of these giant Democratic priorities so that he doesn't take the blame for not getting them done. It's one thing to let the focus go on Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but that at least shields him a little bit, because so far it looks like Biden has been uninterested in this issue, when in reality, he's probably just been practical about it, recognizing he's not going to actually be able to win. And presidents generally don't want to expend tons of political capital on something they're not going to win.
Right. So it makes me wonder if this is, Eliza, the president recognizing in the short term, or the that he's not going to achieve these, let's say the two priorities, Build Back Better in its present form at least, and voting rights. So is he playing the long game, meaning I may not make them, but I'm going to show that I was fighting the good fight, and that's what counts?
I'm not quite sure what is happening, because what happened yesterday shouldn't really be a surprise to anyone. I mean, I think how Sinema did it right before Biden showed up was absolutely a dig. And as one Republican senator said to me yesterday, she was putting an exclamation point on a point she's already made many times. But this whole thing was sort of this exercise in delusion. I mean, they were proceeding with something that they did not have the votes for and promising that it would happen by Monday. It's now been bumped because of winter storms and a senator out with COVID and all sorts of things. But they didn't have the votes on Wednesday either. Build Back Better at least came a lot closer. It really did seem like they would be able to pull that off, and Manchin pulled the plug at the last minute. But on this, I think there's absolutely a sense from the White House, from Democrats, that they do need to be seen as fighting on this. I mean, earlier, Biden's really low approval ratings were brought up. He is struggling with his public image. They're going into the 22 midterms where Democrats, at least in the House, are seen as the underdogs. And so they do need to rally the base. The people who brought Biden and Democrats in are not very happy with them right now. And so I think there is a real sense that they need to be seen as doing all that they can. But it is sort of this weird thing for those of us who've been on Capitol Hill every day covering this, because they've been proceeding with something, acting as if they can pull it off at the last minute. And there was really no indication that that would happen other than meetings. But people would walk out of the meetings and say their minds weren't changed. So I think yesterday maybe put that exclamation point on it. But it's not a surprise that Sinema and Manchin don't want to change the filibuster rule. I mean, they've been there for a really long time.
Jeff, you mentioned, first to mention here on the podcast, I thought everyone else has, I think, Kyrsten Sinema's speech yesterday, even before President Biden got in the limousine to drive to Capitol Hill, she basically said, "You're wasting your time coming up here, as far as I'm concerned." She went to the Senate floor and gave the speech. Here's just a little clip.
These bills help treat the symptoms of the disease, but they do not fully address the disease itself. And while I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country. The debate over the Senate 60-vote threshold shines a light on our broader challenges. There's no need for me to restate my longstanding support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation.
Translation, Jeff, right? I'm all for these bills, but I won't do anything to help them pass.
Pretty much. Now, there is a subtext under here, which I've gotten from a few moderate Democrats and their staff. Eliza hinted at this with the with how things are probably going to shake out for Democrats in the fall. They are hesitant, Sinema, Manchin. They're hesitant to weaken the filibuster, partly because they're concerned that Democrats are going to be in the minority in a year and it's going to be used against them.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2024, they've got unified government right now. In 2024, they could find themselves on the losing end of unified government. And this is one of the few checks they have against unified Republican rule. And I know we're going to talk about Harry Reid later. We see the example of Harry Reid. When you weaken the filibuster a little bit, you're daring the other side to come around and do it later. And I think that's what primarily she's concerned about.
Right. So Sudeep, his fire was aimed more at Republicans still than at public fire, at least, than against Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And we hear the president with a tone of voice and a rhetoric that we hadn't really seen from Biden before. Here's President Biden from his speech down in Atlanta.
Not a single Republican has displayed the courage to stand up to a defeated president to protect America's right to vote. Not one. Not one.
Not a single Republican. Sudeep, this is, I call it, kind of Biden unchained. We saw on January 6th. We saw it in Atlanta. We saw it yesterday. in the Senate. What's going on? Is this no more Mr. Nice Guy?
Well, yeah, the Republicans who have stood up in the rare cases across the country are becoming extinct because they're no longer likely to be Republicans because of the sway that Donald Trump has over the party. Joe Biden is probably at his best when he is attacking the role of Donald Trump in politics and American society. That is kind of why he ran for office. He saw this as a mission. This is part of what he has said will determine whether he's going to run for another term, is whether he's up against Trump. And so he's trying to bring that passion to bear here and make the point. The politics of this are that these are like sweeping changes across the country, and he has to show with the bully pulpit how profound some of these changes can be. Not all of them, but many of them are going to be seen as critical factors in the next election. We need to actually have some conversations about those specific cases, and he can shine a light on them, even if he can't do anything about them. Because of the fact that he does have a couple of members in the Senate who are just not there yet, and we've seen in other years when you push too hard on some senators, they flip parties. We're not going to see that in these cases with Sinema and Manchin, but that is just the reality that they're not fully fledged and bought into the Democratic agenda right now.
Right. So, Eliza, covering the Capitol as you do every day, a lot of action on the part of the Select Committee on January 6th this week. They invited House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy to come and tell them what happened with his conversations with Donald Trump on January 6th. Our colleague and our frequent roundtable guest, Scott Wong, one of your colleagues on the Hill, Eliza, posed this question to Kevin McCarthy at his press briefing, I believe it was Wednesday, maybe yesterday. Here he is.
Doesn't the American public have a right to know what the President of the United States was thinking and doing while the U.S. Capitol was under attack?
You know, that's a great question. You know the great thing about that? I didn't wait a year later. On January 6th, I spoke to the American public. Not by one network, but by many networks.
Well, he did, Eliza, but he quickly changed his tune, right?
Right. So right after January 6th, he said that, you know, some of the blame lay with President Trump. He has really reversed that, and sort of his new line is there's blame to go around. This is something we've seen with actually a lot of Republicans right after. I mean, we saw Lindsey Graham say something like, I'm out. I'm not doing this anymore. And obviously he's close to Trump. He's been golfing with him since. But yeah, McCarthy declined to talk to the Select Committee. At this point, it is voluntary. We've seen that also with Congressman Jim Jordan, Congressman Scott Perry, two others that they've asked to talk to them. They have not ruled out subpoenaing McCarthy, which is, I mean, this would be really unprecedented territory. We're already in it, asking them to come in and talk, but we'll just have to see. But him saying no, I think, is the beginning of what's going to be quite an intense saga and just further fuel the partisanship we see in the House in particular.
And Jeff, the other news out of the committee this week is that they charged the head of the Oath Keepers with sedition, the Justice Department did, charging him with sedition. This takes this investigation and this issue to a whole new level, doesn't it?
Does, because in part it undercuts one of the major arguments of the Republicans and other folks who have been kind of minimizing January 6th. They like to say, well, you can't call it an insurrection. No one's actually been charged with treason. Well, okay, now we essentially have
right.
So that becomes a trickier rope for them to hoe. And I'm curious also, the other thing I think was really interesting this week is that Adam Kinzinger was on a podcast yesterday, and he says that they're going to do this in prime time. They want everybody to hear it. And he says even right now, they've got enough to make a really compelling case to people, and they expect to get more. Now, whether that's going to change anybody's vote for the fall, whether anybody's actually going to vote on January 6th as an election issue is another matter. But he's really confident that as a matter of history and the historical record, they've already got a really compelling case to put forward.
Right. So Sandeep, you mentioned earlier the influence that Donald Trump continues to have, maybe growing influence over Republicans running for office. And I'm reminded of this because Eliza just mentioned Lindsey Graham as one of those who really condemned Donald Trump for his role in January 6th immediately afterwards. But since is singing a different tune, here is Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, this week casting some aspersion on Mitch McConnell himself with this comment, I believe, Lindsey Graham.
Well, elections are about the future. If you want to be a Republican leader in the House or the Senate, you have to have a working relationship with President Donald Trump. He's the most consequential Republican since Ronald Reagan. It's his nomination if he wants it, and I think he'll get reelected in 2024.
There you go, Sandeep. He's laying it out, right?
Oh, boy, Lindsey Graham. You know, one thing he said a little over a year ago, it does just stick with me when he was so impassioned with his Enough is Enough speech, saying that when he was certifying the election, saying, count me out of this. And that lasted about as long as a lot of people's discuss with an insurrection. And here we are where he's come back around and realized the political reality that he's living in, which is kind of the Lindsey Graham way over the last few years and why he's attached himself so closely to Trump. This is probably going to be the way we have to talk about this for the next 3 years, or at least the next 2 years, because there are only going to be a handful of Liz Cheney's and Adam Kinzinger's and others, as we've seen with Senator Rounds this week, when they come out and try yep. to defend the facts of the case, they get destroyed. And we've seen exactly the same thing happen to Cheney and Kinzinger before. So when Senator Rounds made his declaration that he's looked into the facts and they are what they are and people need to move on from this, he is probably wondering whether he's going to become extinct as well.
Indeed. All right. Well, enough is enough about the goings on with the voting rights and some of those other battles on Capitol Hill. Lots of other issues to cover, which we will do. Let's take a quick break first here on the Bill Press Pod and then come back with today's panelists, Eliza Collins from Wall Street Journal, Sandeep Reddy from Politico, and Jeff Dufour from the National Journal. And today's roundtable brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, otherwise known as the Teamsters Union, 1.5 million strong in the United States and Canada under the leadership of President Jim Hoffa, outgoing President Jim Hoffa, I might add. The Teamsters, the largest and most diverse of all American labor unions, representing every aspect of the American workforce, from vegetable workers in California, construction workers in Las Vegas, brewery workers in St. Louis, and bakers in Maine. As they say, they represent everybody from A to Z, airline pilots to zookeepers. We salute the members of the Teamsters, thank them for their great work, and particularly for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. Today's roundtable and today's panelist, Sudeep Reddy, joining us, managing editor of Politico. Jeff Dufour, editor-in-chief of the National Journal. Eliza Collins, political reporter for the Wall Street Journal. It was high drama, Eliza, on Capitol Hill this week. Yet another hearing about the administration's response to the COVID crisis. And yet another fiery exchange between Senator Rand Paul and Anthony Fauci. Why, you ask, does Rand Paul, why is he going after Anthony Fauci? Dr. Fauci had his take on that at the hearing. He fires back.
What happens when he gets out and accuses me of things that are completely untrue is that all of a sudden that kindles the crazies out there. So I ask myself, why would Senator want to do this? So go to Rand Paul website and you see fire Dr. Fauci with a little box that says contribute here. So you are making a catastrophic epidemic for your political gain.
Eliza, have you ever seen anything like that?
I think that this was a real breaking point for Fauci. I will note that it is not just Rand Paul who's critical of Fauci, and it really is a much broader group of Republicans who are critical. We even saw in this hearing,
yep,
the only one who really was like thanking Fauci or giving him credit was Mitt Romney, who we have seen, you know, sort of break with Republicans on a handful of things. But what Rand Paul did was, you know, sort of much more aggressive in pushing Fauci. And we saw Fauci sort of break and talk about some of those threats he's received. I mean, this is someone who's really just been a career public official for decades. And because of the pandemic has come in the public eye. I mean, he started in the Trump administration and now has become really this punching bag for Republicans who don't like the administration's policies on coronavirus. So there's lots of criticism to go around, but Rand Paul, maybe one of the, not the only one, but one of the Republicans choosing to fundraise off of that. And I think that Fauci just really has had enough. I mean, over the last couple of years, he's really taken a lot of heat, especially for people who don't like the idea of, you know, vaccine mandates and mask mandates and the things that Fauci and the Biden administration are pushing.
Yeah, well, and obviously, Dr. Fauci came prepared. He held up the page, copies of the pages from Rand Paul's website, right, showing to the media what he was talking about. These are really personal attacks, not attacks on policy, Sudeep. Is there ever such a thing as senators going over the line?
Yes, it does happen from time to time each day, I suppose.
I guess.
This is a case where senators get to do what they do for political gain and usually don't get called out on it because they don't want the people who are affected don't want the backlash, but Fauci's had enough of it, and I think this is just a moment where you can kind of see how powerful this stuff is. The fact that there's a crazy person coming with assault weapons to kill him, and that was picked up for threats, and that is part of what's driving all of this. And we're just a whisker away from something horrific happening as a result of these politics. And we've just seen this over and over again. And when we look back, when one of these moments happen, you will see all of these specific instances leading into it. And just your breath has to stop when you see these over and over again. And that's what Fauci recognizes here.
I must say, on a personal note, I only met Dr. Fauci once, and it was just before the holidays. I ran into him at an event, and I thanked him for the work that he's doing and said to him, "I'm sorry for all the shit you've had to take." And Fauci said, "I'm still taking shit every day." Well, proof of the pudding. There it is. Bouncing around, Jeff, Donald Trump, big interview on NPR this week. Didn't go too well, right?
Well, the first question we have to ask ourselves is, why did Donald Trump agree to an interview with NPR to begin with?
Maybe why did NPR want to interview Donald Trump to begin with?
Well, you could see that. From what I read, Inskeep had been working on this for a long time.
Right.
And apparently he got a champion somewhere in Trump world, and Trump finally agreed to do it. But if you're Donald Trump, I can't imagine what you thought was going to happen and that it was going to end any differently than it ended. And truthfully, if you're Steve Inskeep, I can't imagine that you would imagine it would have ended any differently either than Trump hanging up. The questions were, you know, you could have written the script of this beforehand as an observer. I did think it was really interesting that Trump was doing an interview that wasn't on Fox, Newsmax, or OAN, mm-hmm. or Alex Jones, or wherever. So I think that was notable. What Trump said and what he did was not really notable or surprising at all. It played out exactly as I thought it would.
Yeah, he said basically repeating the same lies he's told everybody else. The part of the interview I remember is just that, look, nobody showed up at Joe Biden's rallies. How could he get 80 million votes, right? And look at all the people that came to my rallies. So.
Right. And then he listed off a couple of politicians, Kari Lake in Arizona, who he said are, quote, really good on this issue, i.e. the issue that the 2020 election was somehow stolen. Right. So he's still pushing this. He's going to push it. I don't know that he's constitutionally capable of admitting that he lost. So I don't think we're ever going to get a different tune out of him.
Yeah. So on the political side, Eliza, something that I find puzzling this week is the chair of the Republican National Committee, Ronna McDaniel, who never wants us to remind people that she is the niece of Mitt Romney. She announced that they were going to tell Republican candidates in 2024 not to participate in presidential debates run by the Commission on Presidential Debates. Really? I mean, what, are they going to have an empty chair? This is good for the party? What's going on?
Yeah, I can't even begin to speculate what's going on, other than that this was something that, you know, President Trump and his team were unhappy with dealing with them in 2020. There were lots of issues. It was public. I believe there was a debate skipped. I don't know if this is trying to appease Trump and his team or what, but it seems really strange at the beginning of 2022 to take hard lines like this when we're not even through the midterms. You know, we don't really see the RNC weigh in on a lot of things. Another thing to point out is that usually by the time this comes around, Republicans have their candidate, and basically it's their allies that are in the RNC. So in theory, it could be a different group of people, at least, you know, at the top. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure if this sticks, but they're certainly weighing in maybe to keep people's minds on 24. I'm just not quite sure what's going on there.
Yeah. So Deep, and also the commission, and I know a couple of members of the commission very well, they negotiate and they make their deals with the candidates, right? What, not with the national committee. So you're the Republican nominee for president and you're not going to debate your opponent?
Yeah, this whole thing is so wild. The chair of the Commission on Presidential Debates is the former chair of the RNC throughout the 1980s right. and the Reagan years. And that just shows how far we've come. And this is the Trump Republican Party. And obviously this is his intent here is to at least keep people on their toes, thinking that it's going to be another Trump-driven cycle that goes into this. I think almost any other Republican would probably want to see the debates happen in a forum that they can actually get all the attention for, because it is a big audience. And so this is really just another thing that comes down to the Trump factor of whether he'll run or not.
So, Jeff, and you mentioned earlier we wanted to touch on this. The man from Searchlight, Nevada, came back to the United States Capitol to lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda. I thought it was remarkable that Republicans and Democrats, they all took time to come out and pay their respects. It was one rare moment of unity and coming together.
It was, and we saw this really twice in the span of what, about a month, with Bob Dole mm-hmm. and then Harry Reid, where you had people from both parties coming out to pay their respects. With Reid, I must admit, I was a little bit more surprised. I thought some Republicans would stay away just because Reid was so prickly at times, to put it mildly.
It's a good word for him. Yeah,
he wasn't always the most personally warm kind of guy. I guess you could say he was sort of the Democratic inverse of Mitch McConnell. Very, very effective, but not exactly the warmest guy you could find. And as I hinted at before, I thought historically it was really interesting, the timing of all this, at a time when we're talking about and debating the future of the filibuster, to see people remembering Harry Reid, who one of his primary legacies,
right.
it has to be said, is weakening the filibuster for judicial nominees, which Republicans then took and essentially weakened for all judicial nominees all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Eliza, were you there when Harry Reid was majority leader? And does his influence or impact still kind of resonate in the Senate?
I was not on the Hill yet when he was majority leader, mm-hmm. but it absolutely does. I mean, Schumer is sort of his hand-picked number
yep.
two. Reid was his mentor. They have very different styles. I mean, when we're talking about Reid being prickly, Schumer is the opposite of that. He, you know, Reid is known for hanging up his phone mid-conversation. Schumer is known for his flip phone, for knowing every senator's phone number and calling them constantly. So they have very different styles, but you know, Schumer came up under Reid. And so I think that is a huge part of it. And then just the conversation around the filibuster. I mean, Reid did weaken the filibuster. He basically made the first move. And now they're talking about getting rid of it altogether. But he has certainly played a role and continues to play a role in the Senate. And for better or for worse, Schumer is compared to him a lot. I mean, talking about this voting rights, rules change, vote series in the coming week, I'm talking to a lot of people who keep comparing Schumer to Reid. So he does cast a long shadow.
Yeah. Sudeep, it does make you wonder, following up on Eliza's comments, how Harry Reid would handle this impasse over both voting rights and the Build Back Better. It makes me think that he'd be able to find a way to get both done.
You know, at least on Build Back Better, you'd think he would have been able to pull that off. But the reality here is Harry Reid recognized in that the political environment was changing tremendously when he got to changing the filibuster for justices, because he was really the first person to have to deal with the Tea Party movement. And mm-hmm. a completely different environment in the Senate, a completely different set of politics about how what's being done. And that was obviously the very start of the social media era and the height of Fox News, and all of this must have influenced his thinking in a way that probably Biden is coming around to right now, and recognizing that it's not the old Senate. It's a different environment. Times have changed, and They all felt it was more dire than before. But these will be these will go down as historical markers for why the country changed so much in this period. Is partly because of what was happening around at that time that led the Senate to change.
Okay, great roundup of the big news of the week here from Washington, D.C., with today's panelists, Eliza Collins, Jeff Dufour, and Sudeep Reddy. And with all of that going on, there's always one story that makes you stop in your tracks and say, oh, wow, look at that. Makes you either laugh or cry or scratch your head. We call it our favorite story of the week. Jeff Dufour, start us off. What caught your attention?
Well, it's a headline that caught my attention. It's a little morbid. It's a little dark. But the headline from the Washington Post yesterday reads, quote, "The ethics of a second chance. Pig heart transplant recipient stabbed a man seven times years ago."
Oh, I saw that. Oh, God.
Chef's kiss. Now, this is, of course, the guy who got the experimental pig heart, the first guy ever to do it. And they the reporter dug around in his background. Sure enough, a couple decades ago, he had he apparently tried to kill a guy by stabbing him seven times
and leaving him paralyzed for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Now, so on the one hand, we are not a society that rations healthcare or makes healthcare available based on someone's previous life choices, but. But then again, nor did I think we were living in a Wes Craven movie, where the local murderer gets an experimental heart so he can then continue his wicked ways.
Yeah, the guy went to prison, served his time, came out, and then obviously health problems, and he gets this heart. It did make you wonder, right? Who makes the decisions?
Okay, yeah, you can't make it up.
Oh. Well, top that, Sudeep. Your favorite story of the week.
That is an incredible one. As I was reading through it, I have to go back to the combination of so many things we've talked about this week: vaccines and Donald Trump. And I just stopped in my tracks on the screen when I saw this reference to the former president on OAN calling politicians who wouldn't disclose their booster status gutless. Gutless. Who would have thought in all of the bizarre politics of the last year, it would be Donald Trump who's accusing politicians of being gutless for not talking about the booster? It just shows that, like, obviously, Trump has acknowledged that he got the booster, and anybody who's trying to challenge him for it is going to get ripped apart. And in this case, it was an unnamed reference to the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis. This was DeSantis not willing to say that. But it just really underscores how much different of a situation we'd be in this moment if Trump and others had been pushing for vaccination and a booster rather than just acknowledging it grudgingly when they've gotten the question. Trump realizes he's probably losing a lot of supporters. A lot of his supporters are probably dying off by not getting vaccinated and boosted, and losing 1,500 or 2,000 people a day if they're slightly more Trump leaning is going to be a problem for him in a couple of years.
Well, I found his gutless comment particularly amusing because, as we recall, he was not exactly forthright when he got the vaccine,
exactly.
the first time or the second time, or even when he got the booster, right? It was sort of a very, very deep secret.
He wasn't forthright when he got the disease.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. How about your favorite story there, Eliza?
Okay, I'm going to go a completely different direction than both of
you
those.
Got it.
But some of my colleagues at the Wall Street Journal last night had a story about TikTok stars making more than Fortune 500 CEOs.
Yes.
And you said head scratching. I mean, this just blows my mind. Someone who posts videos of them dancing, she made $17.5 million last year, which compare that to ExxonMobil's CEO who made $15 million, Starbucks $14 million. I mean, and she's not alone. She's just like the top earner. So it blows my mind that these people are making more money for TikTok videos.
It is insane. Absolutely insane. All right. Well, my favorite story of the week. Thank you, all of you, for not mentioning it. I was afraid one of you might steal it from me because the was the fact that the crowds on Capitol Hill this week were not crowds of protesters. They were crowds of bird watchers because, as appeared on Capitol Hill, a snowy owl has made its way from the Arctic down to Washington, D.C. It seems to be hanging out at Union Station, where it's been seen on the globe on top of the statue there, a monument to Columbus, Christopher Columbus, in the center of the circle. And the snowy owl has attracted crowds of bird watchers. It's been seen around the Capitol. It's been seen around the Capitol, the Senate and House office buildings, and flying around the neighborhoods of Capitol Hill. Sudeep, I don't know whether you've had a chance to spot it. I haven't yet, but
I've been looking, haven't seen it.
I love the fact it's getting so much attention, and it is staying around, even though it must be very lonely, because it is thriving on rats and pigeons, all of which are to be found in great numbers at Union Station. I can attest to that. And so we welcome the snowy owl to Washington, D.C., salute it, and thank it for its contribution of helping us get rid of our population of rats and pigeons. There's to the snowy owl. All right, a big thank you to Eliza Collins from the Wall Street Journal, Jeff Dufour from the National Journal, Sudeep Reddy from Politico. Thank you, panelists, and thank you all, good friends and neighbors, for listening today, being part of the podcast. Have a great weekend. Take care of yourselves, please. Omicron, yeah, the levels may be, going down, but it's still a real risk out there. So be very, very careful when wear that N95 mask. Take care of yourselves, and then come back and see us on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.